The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the topic I thought of exploring this evening is a topic of letting go. And we talk about this a lot in this practice and in this room. That word, those words come up a lot. They came up in the meditation that we did. I suggested that perhaps letting go of the way the mind is pulled into thoughts of past or future, you know, letting go of tension in the body. And so this word is used a lot, and the word is connected with in the Buddha's teaching, the second noble truth, which is sometimes we say is the description of how or why we suffer, how or why we struggle, how or why we get into difficulty, and that is because of the mind kind of craving or holding on or wanting to have things be a certain way. And so the teaching around the second noble truth is that we should let go of that craving. But that, like, how do we let go of craving? And what is craving anyway? I mean, so this is the kind of questions I'd like to explore today. It's like, so this is a foundational or a fundamental kind of teaching. The Buddha says that in the first noble truth, he says, we suffer. We struggle. And I don't think we usually contest that. we find ourselves struggling and in distress. And this word dukkha, that is translated as suffering, does mean a variety of kinds of suffering. When we use the word suffering, it often seems to evoke in us, in the English language at least, it evokes something big. Suffering is a big thing. But this word, dukkha, in the Pali, conveys a range from the subtlest kind of just unease or dissatisfaction through to a major distress or what we do call suffering. And so the teaching of the Four Noble Truths is really around suffering, that we do suffer, and then the Buddha pointing out in the Second Noble Truth that, well, there's a kind of suffering, let's say, that is related to something going on in our minds. We often would define suffering as being something external to us, you know, that we're suffering when somebody is doing something to us, or, you know, the pain that we're experiencing when we fall down and hurt our knee or break a leg or something, that pain is suffering. But the Buddha said that kind of suffering, that kind of unpleasant experience, that's going to be there. That's not going to go away. But he did say that there's a relationship in the mind to what's happening in the world, in our minds and bodies. There's a relationship to that that adds a whole layer of suffering from the subtle to the profound. And this is the kind of suffering that we can be free of. And this is where the second noble truth points to this craving. Basically, the relationship to what's happening in the world. We want it to be a certain way. We want certain things to continue. We don't want other things to continue. So there's this craving to have things be a certain way. And this craving, the second noble truth basically says, with the arising of craving comes suffering. So when craving arises, suffering arises. Often this noble truth is framed that craving causes suffering, that the cause of suffering is craving. And we could look at it that way, but also in our language, in the English language, when we say A causes B, we usually think, you know, so A is not B. You know, so when we have A and it causes B, A is not B, it's just kind of, you know, kind of bumping up against it and making something happen. And in this case, the way this is stated, with the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. So the craving is suffering. So to me, that's a subtle, but also it's a distinction that I've seen in my own practice as having a truth to it. That when I actually can touch into the actual experience of craving, there's a leaning towards or a neediness or a kind of a wrapped around something. That experience of that craving is already suffering. It doesn't have to go anywhere. It doesn't have to bump up against anything. The arising of craving is the arising of suffering. And the third noble truth reinforces this kind of almost equivalency between craving and suffering. So whenever there's suffering, there is going to be craving. And wherever there's craving, there's going to be suffering. We don't have one without the other. And the third noble truth reinforces this when it says, with the ending of craving, there is the ending of suffering. And so this points to how the release from the ending of craving is kind of the aim of our practice. And in order to kind of understand this, we need to understand, first of all, a little bit about this craving. The first noble truth also says that, yes, there's suffering, and what we need to do with suffering is to understand it. Not understand it in terms of an intellectual thinking about how did I get here, but understanding in this case being more of a visceral or a kind of an experiential knowing. This is the experience of suffering. This, and so many, many experiences, and many of our reactive emotions, for example, are experienced as suffering, but we don't necessarily know that. So the arising of like frustration, for example, or anger. You know, when we feel those, often we aren't directly, or when those arise, we may not be directly feeling them. We may be more oriented towards the thing that we're frustrated about or the thing that we're angry with. But when we turn to the experience, and this is what I think the Buddha means by understand suffering. When we, instead of orienting our attention to the thing we're frustrated with or angry with or whatever emotion or reactivity we have, instead of orienting to that, we turn instead to, well, what's the experience of being a human being that's having this happen? What's the human experience of experiencing anger? What's the human experience of frustration? When we turn to that with that experience, we understand in a very different way, and maybe sometimes even in a big aha moment. Certainly for me, when I first touched into this around anger, it's like, oh my gosh, anger hurts. I mean, I kind of had known that, but not in this visceral way, because I was so oriented on what I was angry about as opposed to recognizing the anger itself. And so this is what the Buddha means by understanding suffering. The second noble truth, the Buddha says that we need to explore and let go of craving. And so how do we do that? Well, actually, I think that one of the big ways to begin to be able to let go of suffering, to let go of craving, is because craving is suffering, we need to understand craving. So we need to understand craving through this direct experiential kind of understanding. Get familiar with what craving is. And so that piece, I'd like to explore that for part of the talk here. It's like, what is craving? And the Buddha has some ways of describing it. And so I'll kind of go through the classical way that the Buddha talked about the different kinds of craving. He said there's three kinds of craving. The first kind is one that we'll, you know, pretty easily recognize. We have a craving around sense pleasure. We like things to be pleasant. We don't like things to be unpleasant. And it goes beyond just a liking or not liking. It really actually is much more we are driven by wanting to orient and organize our lives around having pleasant and getting rid of unpleasant. And so that's one form of craving, and we'll go into that in a little bit more in a moment. I'll just do a little overview here first. Then the other two forms of craving they may sound a little bit obscure, but again, we'll get into them. The second and third kinds of craving are around a craving for a certain kind of existence, which might be, it could be related to a certain kind of state of life, or it might be a kind of identification or an identity that you're craving to have, or it might be just craving a state of mind. The texts talk about this in a very metaphysical way, that the craving for existence is about the craving for a pleasant future life. So that's just one way. The commentaries talk about it in that way. The suttas themselves don't give a lot of description about what these the second and third kind of craving are. So we'll go through each of these. The third kind of craving is the craving for non-existence, to not have something, not have some kind of state of being. And so this too is talked about in a metaphysical way, that there might be a craving towards the non existence in a future life, you know, that you basically just are so miserable in this life, I don't want to have another one. So that kind of a craving in that direction. So again, that's the more metaphysical kind of description of that craving. So this first kind, the craving for sense pleasure, this is the teachings, the texts talk about this in terms of a craving for pleasure in connection with our five physical sense bases. So that to me is a piece that may help to elaborate or elucidate the other two kinds of craving, because this first kind of craving is mostly about craving to have pleasant sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch, and not have unpleasant sights, sounds, smells, taste, touch. The sense pleasure itself is not the enemy, and it is not a problem. The issue here, the suffering arises around sense pleasure with the craving. Remember, with the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. Not with the arising of sense pleasure is the arising of suffering. Sense pleasure can happen and will happen. I mentioned earlier, you know, we fall down and we hurt our knee, we break our leg, there's unpleasant sensation. That happens. And just as often, you know, actually when we check it out through our day, you know, we also have pleasant experience. The pleasantness of some particular food or a sight as I walked out my door this evening, the sky was this kind of orangey color. It was quite beautiful. Like the pleasantness of that experience. And so the sense pleasure itself isn't the problem. The problem is when the mind kind of begins to attach to it and thinks, okay, this is it. This is the way it needs to be. And I need to kind of construct my life so that I can keep sense pleasure. Now, it may be that we do, and most of us, I think, understand that we're not going to keep a particular sense pleasure. You know, I know that walking out the door, I'm not going to be able to keep that orange sunset. And yet, there's something in the mind that somehow feels like what it should be able to do is to, like pearls on a string, be able to line up. Oh, that was a nice, pleasurable moment. Okay, the next one, please. And get the next one, and the next one, and the next one. And we think there should be some kind of control that we seem to think that if we can't control our lives in that way, that there's something wrong with us. That if we can't, you know, control such that we're continually getting what we want, getting rid of what we don't want, because that's both sides of this are craving. Wanting to have the pleasant, wanting to get rid of the unpleasant. Both sides of this are craving. And we seem to have this kind of underlying belief that if I'm not able to navigate my life such that I kind of can have this pleasant stuff and not have the unpleasant stuff, that somehow I'm doing it wrong. As opposed to just simply recognizing, well, this is the nature of things, you know, pleasant comes, unpleasant comes. This is just the nature of experience. And so the Buddha pointed to the craving to sense pleasure. Is this a big piece of where we suffer? That in this whole project of trying to keep the pleasant, get rid of the unpleasant, or to kind of continually find the next hit of pleasant. And this is the way the mind actually works. It's like it gets a hit of pleasant. There is a kind of happiness that comes with that. And the Buddha actually acknowledges this. He says, yes, you know, when there's association with the pleasant, there's a happiness that comes with that. Dissociation with the unpleasant, there's a happiness that comes with that. But it doesn't last for very long. And so, there is that kind of pleasure that comes with getting what we want. But there's also another thing that happens there that's worth kind of, in terms of understanding craving, that's worth exploring. Because that moment when we get something that we want, there's the having of the pleasant thing, which is itself pleasant. But there is also that when we have that kind of that craving or that wanting to get something pleasant, which often is involved in our movement to get what we want and get rid of what we don't want, that wanting, that craving, when we get something that we want for just a moment, there's a kind of a feeling of satisfaction, a little bit of a feeling of oh, got that thing. So what happens in that moment of satisfaction is that the craving for that pleasant thing or to get rid of that unpleasant thing, that craving goes away. And that is also pleasant. The ending of craving is pleasant. But our minds don't understand so much that it's like in looking at this whole process, so in the moment when we get something that we want, we get a double hit of pleasant, something a bit of pleasant that comes from the association with the pleasant, and the hit of pleasant that comes with the ending of the craving, which is unpleasant, actually, when we look at it, when we start to see the experience of craving itself. And so this is that piece of understanding craving, beginning to get curious about that experience. What is craving? When we want something, you know, when we want something. And this is actually a good exercise. The next time you maybe want some kind of a treat of some kind of a you know, a cup of coffee or something. Play with for a few minutes just watching the wanting. Rather than immediately going to get it, notice the kind of pull to have it, that kind of feeling of destabilization. Gotta have that thing. What does that feel like? Get familiar with that feeling itself and notice the unpleasantness of it. When we start to recognize that, sometimes we can begin to see that kind of movement, that kind of craving, that mind that tells me I need to have something. That mind of craving actually does not understand or only believes that the having of the thing is what's going to make me feel better. So craving believes that I got to have that thing. But when we watch this process, I tell this story a lot, but I was sitting at a stoplight one day. It was kind of a long stoplight, and I was letting my eyes kind of wander around, and I noticed there was a Starbucks across the street. And that created the idea of a latte in my mind, and that sounded good, and you know, the craving for the latte sprung up. And fortunately, in a way, the light was red for long enough that I got to see this. Like, oh, there's craving. Okay, let's play with this. I'll watch this craving. And I also made the choice in that moment. I'm not going to stop at Starbucks. I'm just going to watch this and see what happens. And so as the light turned green and I went through the stoplight and then turned the corner where it would be so easy to just turn into the Starbucks. The craving got stronger. I could feel it kind of get a little tighter. And then I drove past it, past the point where it would be a real hassle to turn around, and the craving went away. So, and there is a feeling of release there. There's a kind of a feeling of, oh, wow. You know, the feeling of being caught by craving is a feeling of being like caught in a vice grip. And when we're released from that vice grip, there's an ease, there's a relaxation. This is what that third noble truth means. The ending of craving is the ending of suffering. That as that craving lets go, we're released from that kind of, it's like we're being subjected to some kind of a slave master. Craving is like a slave master. You will do this. So that that kind of curiosity around the craving itself can help us to understand something about the nature of craving. And this is something about understanding the suffering. We see that the craving has essentially been convincing us, you know, when we're caught in the throes of craving, it convinces us that the only way for this feeling to go away, for this unpleasant, tilted kind of dissatisfied feeling to go away is to get the thing that we want or get rid of the thing that we don't want. But this little kind of exploration can show us that actually one of the ways to end that dissatisfaction is for that craving to end. The craving is the dissatisfaction. With that arising of craving, there is the dissatisfaction that arises. When the craving ends, the dissatisfaction ends. And so the Buddha encouraged us to explore sense pleasure, explore it from this perspective of, you know, how it plays with craving. And in particular, one thing he encouraged us to look at was, as he said, so sense pleasure does give us some happiness when we get it. But what he wanted us to look at is kind of the forgetfulness that, you know, we think somehow that having that thing is going to be it's going to do it for us somehow. You know, and it is kind of amazing. There have been times on retreats when I've explored this around like chocolate. You know, just watching the wanting of chocolate. And in the moment of being caught in the thrall of that wanting of chocolate, there is a way that the mind believes that having that piece of chocolate, that is really what is going to make me happy, like for a long time. It's like such a delusive quality of mind, this craving. And so the Buddha encourages us to recognize with sense pleasure, what is the gratification? How gratifying is sense pleasure? So noticing the happiness of having something that we want, but then he encourages us with that gratification to notice how long it lasts. He says, notice the extent of the gratification. And so this is a piece that really encourages us, particularly with sense pleasure, to recognize that what we're craving and the craving and the thing that we get following that craving is such a small, ephemeral kind of experience. Sense pleasure doesn't last for very long. And so watching that, getting to know that, being curious about how long does sense pleasure actually last, this helps us to see the, kind of to undermine the craving's perspective that, yes, that thing, having that thing will make me happy for a long time. As we begin to see that that sense pleasure is just going to go away in a few moments, and then the mind's going to be jumping on the wheel of the next thing. And that's what happens. As soon as the mind, we get something that we want, the wanting goes away, we have a sense of a feeling of, oh, things are good now. But that all goes away pretty quickly. And so what happens next? As that sense of satisfaction fades, the sense of satisfaction of having something fades, is that we think, our mind goes, well, when was the last time I felt really good? Oh, it was when I got something I wanted. So let's see, maybe there's something I can want to want. And so we end up craving something to crave, and our minds actually start searching out things to get, searching out things to get rid of. And this is actually, we can see this in our minds. Certain minds maybe have more of a proclivity towards the pleasant. And we can kind of check this out or even just do a little mind experiment. When you walk into a room for the first time, what is your mind drawn to? You know, is it drawn to what you like about the room? Is it drawn to what you think you don't like about the room? Or maybe it's kind of confused about where do I fit in? What's going on here? Those are roughly three orientations to the world that the Buddhist psychology speaks about. And for those of us who kind of have an aversive bent, for me, I have an aversive bent. When I walk into a room, I immediately see, there's a stain on the carpet over there. There's nothing on the walls. It's really boring in here. Why can't they have a little more color? You know, I'm oriented to what I don't like. And so this is the orientation of the mind. It searches out something to not like. And for others, there's kind of a more of a greedy orientation to the world. And maybe in that case, they may walk in and say, wow, that window is really beautiful. Look at how it frames that side of the wall. And so sometimes the mind will search out the pleasant and not see the unpleasant. And then there's the kind of mind that kind of is in a kind of a more place of delusion, not really clear on what's going on. And that may be the third type, a person who walks into a room and it's, what's happening? What do I do here? Shoes on, shoes off. So the mind, through habit, through the kind of habits, the ways that we've engaged in the world, will have a proclivity towards pleasant or unpleasant, and there's an orientation there. And so when something ends, like for me, my whole mode of experiencing life for many years had been, and it still is in this direction, although it's much softer now, looking for things that are unpleasant so that I can fix them so that I'll be okay. And so that's the orientation. You know, that's what the mind tends to do. As soon as something is fixed and it's okay, it's like, okay, well, it's okay, but there's probably something else I better look for. Probably something else out there I better figure out how to fix. So it doesn't just land there with that thing. It's got this habit of stepping on that wheel of wanting. What's the next thing I can get or get rid of? What's the next thing I can control or hold on to or fix or change? Whew, it's okay now, but it won't be in a minute, so let me find the next thing. So this is the what the Buddha calls the danger of sense pleasure. That because we have this kind of hook on this wheel, that without understanding that sense that we're just caught on this cycle of craving, that we just go from the next sense pleasure to the next sense pleasure to the next sense pleasure, or get rid of the sense pleasure to get rid of the next one, to get rid of the next one, to fix, to change, to control. We're on that wheel without ever realizing it's craving driving the whole thing. And so the encouragement is to notice what the gratification is, and then how long does it extend? And that begins to undermine a little bit this belief that's embedded in the craving, that having is going to be somehow good for me. Because the mind is beginning to learn, well, these things don't last very long. I'm just going from one thing that doesn't last very long to the next, and this is exhausting. So we start to recognize that, the danger of this kind of craving. So I like this teaching, the three parts to this. With respect to sense pleasure, the Buddha says, well, how is it gratifying? And then how is it dangerous? What is the danger of sense pleasure? And then how can we kind of let it all go? How can we escape from it? And it is the letting go of the craving that is the escape from this being bound to this wheel of needing this one sense pleasure after another. So then the other two kinds of craving, these are a little more, maybe a little less tangible. I mean, the craving for sense pleasure is something that we all can begin to recognize. And as we start to explore it, we can begin to understand the danger of it. Maybe not immediately, but this is why I like this teaching, because he says we start with recognizing the gratification. That's where we are with sense pleasure a lot of the time. We think it's gratifying. And so the Buddha says, well, start there. Notice that it's gratifying, but then notice how long it lasts. And that begins to point us to the problem with that craving of sense pleasure. So the craving for existence and for non-existence, as I said earlier, the commentaries point to a kind of a metaphysical meaning for these two, that we're either craving for existence in heavenly realms, a craving for a nice rebirth, and so our actions in this life are motivated by some kind of craving for some future life, something in some future existence beyond death. And likewise, the craving for non-existence would be the craving for there to be a complete ending at death. Kind of like an annihilation of being, or a sense of just get me out of here. So these are pretty, and actually some of the more modern day commentators on the suttas, Bhikkhu Bodhi for one, who is responsible for translating the bulk of the Buddhist teachings into English, modern English. He says this is a pretty limited definition of the craving for existence and non-existence. And so I said earlier that the craving around the sense pleasure is around the craving for the five pleasantness around the five physical senses. Having pleasant in the five physical senses, getting rid of unpleasant in the five physical senses. There's also a lot of craving, whole realms of craving, in terms of what goes on in our mind. We crave certain thoughts. We crave certain states of mind. We crave certain kinds of identities, a sense of being someone. This is another way to explore these kinds of craving. One way we might think about it just for now is just like identities. You know, what is an existence? And we can see in our lives that we kind of have a lot of different kinds of identities, and maybe we kind of Just even roles. We can think about different roles that we have, a parent or a daughter, a partner or a coworker or a boss or a subordinate. You know, we have all these different roles that we have, and we may be identified with some of them. You know, just there's kind of this, we cycle through these through the day, and for instance, for myself, the identity of being a child to my parents, to being a daughter, has a very different kind of feeling. You know, there's a kind of a sense of that. There's a feeling related to being a daughter that's very different from that of being a teacher, a Dharma teacher. And so there's these different kind of feelings that we go through in terms of various identities that we have. And we may be attached to some of those identities, feeling that some of them are good or some of them are not good. And this could be a way to look at this craving around existence and non-existence. So maybe we find ourselves. So, here's an example from my own practice. I had this really strong identification, not around a role in particular, but just around not being worthy. And this would come up at times. And there was another identity around being really competent. So these two identities were kind of dueling. They were setups for each other. So the identity that I'm really competent at things, when something would happen and it was shown that I was not competent at everything, the unworthy identity kicked in. And it was like proof that, you know, that this thing happened, that I wasn't competent, is proof that I was unworthy. And so these two identities, quite strong for me, there was a very strong sense of craving for the competent identity and a craving for the non-existence of the unworthy identity. So they were both of those had, there was a craving around them. You know, I didn't want to feel that unworthiness. I didn't want to feel that self-hatred. I wanted to feel the competence. I wanted to feel that. But there wasn't a lot of control over this. This is at times things happened and the feeling of competence arose. At other times things happened and the feeling of unworthiness arose. And at a certain point, I began to recognize that these two identities were like locked into each other. This was quite a recognition for me that I thought what I wanted was to, you know, crave or have this identity of being competent and get rid of this identity of being unworthy. And in some ways, I thought that that's what the practice was supposed to do. It was supposed to make me feel competent all the time and get rid of this unworthiness. You know, that's kind of what my mind was playing with. It's like, well, all I need to do is to figure out what the craving about this unworthiness is, because that needs to go away. That's painful. The mind didn't quite recognize the craving in the competent identity, and that was actually a setup for the unworthy identity. So these two. The craving around either of them was problematic. So the exploration around the craving. I hope that this kind of makes sense. This notion of the craving for a particular identity or the craving for the non-existence of a particular identity. You know, like maybe there are times when you might feel, you know, just this sense of get me out of here. I don't want to be here. That's kind of the craving for non-existence. It might not go as far as, like, you know, the sense of wanting to commit suicide, but just the sense of, yeah, this is, I don't want to be here. This is not what I want. That's the craving for non-existence. Both of them, the craving for some kind of existence, the craving for some kind of thing to be pleasant, the kind of identity to be pleasant, and the craving to get rid of some kind of unpleasant identity, both create suffering. And I think more often than not, many of us have these kind of dueling identities that kind of fuel each other. Paradoxically, what I found I needed to really look at was not the suffering and the craving around the feeling of unworthiness, although I did a lot of that. I looked at that a lot in various ways and times, explored how the mind was believing those stories. But the other thing that I needed to really do was recognize and acknowledge when that identity of, I'm doing this really well, I'm really good at this, when that was arising, and to begin to recognize that kind of feeling of like, oh, that's good, I got to hold on to this. You know, the feeling of kind of, this I have got to make sure this stays. That was suffering. It was not an obvious kind of suffering initially, but began to be more clear as the mind kind of got curious about that side of it. Oh, this feeling of competence. It's like, it's not enough to just have competence happen. Competence can happen. I mean, it's not like I don't have to be competent, but this sense of needing to have that be who I am, that is suffering. That kind of needing to make sure that everything that I do is that way. So this, the craving for existence, the craving for non-existence, maybe we can look at it in terms of that, the identities is a big piece of it, I think, but also it might be just in terms of a state of mind that arises, liking a state of mind, wanting it to continue. Not liking another state of mind. So liking it when we're excited, but not liking it when we're sad. You know, so the not liking it when we're sad is a kind of a not wanting that state. Not wanting that existence that's arising right now. Wanting this existence that's arising right now. So this is a piece of our craving, the wanting, and we can begin to recognize it, I think, in terms of our mind states, in terms of our identities. So in terms of exploring letting go of craving, I think a lot of it has to do with this curiosity first about what craving is, you know, beginning to get familiar with it. As we start to get familiar with it and see how it works, our mind begins to understand the tricks it's trying to play on us. It begins to understand the delusion and the confusion that are embedded in that craving, the beliefs that are embedded in it that actually don't make a lot of sense. Like the idea, for instance, that somehow I could be competent every single second of my life. What a joke. So the looking at this begins to kind of unmask some of the beliefs and the, you know, the delusions that are embedded in the craving. But there's a couple different things to just to know. And the word letting go, I think, has a quality often we might think of as an active kind of doing. That we should somehow be able to let go of craving, meaning, oh, this craving is happening, so I should stop doing that. I should be able to let it go. I should be able to not do that. Sometimes we can set it aside, or we can recognize, ooh, maybe I shouldn't follow through on that. Sometimes there is a possibility to be a little more active around craving, especially when they're big things. You know, that we see, wow, doing that is going to cause a big problem in my world. So let me let go of acting on that. Let me not do that. So there are times when we can see our mind headed in the direction of a doing, an activity of wanting to get something or wanting to get rid of something, and consciously decide, not going to do that. Doesn't look like it's helpful. But the state of mind itself of the wanting to do it, that state itself, while we can choose perhaps not to act on that wish of craving, that kind of momentum of craving, we can sometimes choose to say, I won't follow through on that. What we cannot usually do is say, I'm going to stop craving. And that's where another form of practice is really useful. First of all, to know that this is normal. You know, it is this teaching around letting go of craving. We could say, in effect, that the teaching around letting go of craving may be to let go of acting on craving when that's possible, and even that's not always possible. But then the next piece of it is to not try to repress, because that's what we might tend to do. Given that we might think, oh, I shouldn't be feeling this craving. I'm supposed to let go of craving. So I should be able to stop this craving. We can't generally do that. We can't generally stop that state of mind. And when we try to do that, what it ends up doing usually is repressing it. We're kind of pushing it down underground. And that actually kind of makes it rebound on us later often. So the kind of thing that we need to gain some confidence in and learn to trust is valuable is to be curious. So when we recognize, wow, really want to do something, but that doesn't look so helpful, so I'm not going to do it. But not to ignore the craving there, to be with it, to watch it, to get familiar with it. This is a different kind of approach, being with the craving. We could say, instead of letting go, we're letting go of the acting on the craving. But then in terms of our mindfulness, we are exploring letting craving be, being aware of that experience. Fully allowing that craving to be there, neither acting on it nor repressing it. That gives us the education, that gives us the different experience, the kind of the recognition that craving is suffering. And our minds will begin to recognize, when we see that, when our minds see that craving is suffering, our minds will begin to unfortunately, our minds don't want to have unease. Our minds want to move in the direction of well-being. It's kind of a movement of our minds. And when our minds get better information about what's going on in there, there's an awful lot of stuff going on in our minds that's been hidden from us. And sometimes for good reason that, you know, there's a lot of information in there that we don't, if we saw it all the time, we'd be overwhelmed. But there's also a lot of barriers or boundaries to, you know, what's actually motivating us. And this is a place where we can begin to get curious. So what's motivating us? And as we look at that and see, oh, this craving is motivating. And the mind begins to recognize that motivation in the moment of motivating us is not well-being. Our mind begins to kind of readjust and recalibrate and begins to let it go. It begins to move more in the direction of what is well-being. And craving is not well-being. So another story I tell quite a lot, but really does feel like it talks about this kind of letting be. And it took me a while to really shift from a kind of a repressing of the wanting to a letting it be and watching it. But so this was on a long retreat, and I was noticing that I was experiencing a lot of wanting around looking at people. We were told not to look at people on the retreat. You know, we were told to kind of keep our eyes down. And I really wanted to look at people. But I was going to be a good yogi. I was that competent person, so I was going to do it right. And I was not going to look at people. And so I kind of had blinders on. And yet I really wanted to look at people. I could feel the suffering of that. I could feel the kind of pull. But my first approach was really the repression. It's like, no, I'm not going to look at people. I am a competent yogi. I do this right. And I'm not going to look at people. I wasn't really noticing the wanting. At some point, after weeks of blinders on, repressing, doing what I thought I was supposed to do, doing it right, I recognized, wow, well, what's actually happening here is wanting is happening. The mind is craving this contact to look at people. Maybe I should maybe not look at people, but not also repress that wanting, which is what I had been doing, really, is repressing the wanting to do what I was told, what I thought I was told to do. Don't look at people. And so I began, rather than having that repression kind of just, I'm not going to look, it was more like, oh, there's this wanting. Wow, it's really strong when somebody is right there. Wow, it's hard not to look up. Feeling that kind of pull, you know, feeling that kind of aim and like, just like, oh, really want to look. Feeling the suffering of it. And then seeing, this is the next piece of what the Buddha talked about in terms of the, you know, noticing how long things last. So one thing I noticed here was, so I was watching the suffering, I was watching the craving, and the person would be kind of close, easy to look at, and then they would do something else. They would go behind something or into a door. And in that moment, just as they would go into the building, the whole thing would end. The craving would end. That was an amazing kind of aha moment for me. That was where I really got, that's the moment where I really got the feeling of craving being like a vice grip. Because it felt like when that person went into the building and the craving for looking at them was gone, it felt like the mind had been released from a vice grip. I didn't want to follow the person into the building to find out who they were. The craving was gone. It was no longer relevant. And so this is the kind of exploration that we can do around craving, being curious about it with respect to all the different kinds of craving, with respect to the sense pleasure, with respect to these various kind of identities that we have. So it's time to stop. Sorry, there's no time for questions or comments. Thank you for your attention.